tenderness, that day taking my hand.
Now, with Ivy erased, I've become the trick. I'm a grotesquerie, going out into the world, fetching observations and encounters to perform for someone who's long ago left the building. As I sat there at home in Joe's office, a toxic, roiling mass bloomed in my stomach. Guilt, longing, regret, name it was in me, black, corroding me from within. I couldn't help that being cold-cocked with a reminder of Ivy triggered this wave of nausea and weakness. What was I feeling? It wasn't me. It was an isolated sensation that appeared in my stomach. It had edges. My job was to recognize it as an entity separate from myself. Smell the soup. Cool the soup. I'd rather be me right now. Ivy was off living a life of idiotic facades, laughable values. I stopped myself. I wasn't doing that. My business was my life. My life was an honorable one of self-generating abundance. I was healthy. Timby was healthy. Joe was healthy. I was loved. I'd made an impact as an artist. I had a graphic memoir to write. So what if I didn't get along with my sister? I stood up, still a bit trembly, and started to leave, then stopped. On Joe's desk, a telescope of some kind, gray, the size of a demi-baguette, on crouching insect legs. It was aimed out the window. How bizarre.
I want to see.
It was Timby, followed by Spencer, his face covered in tiny flower stickers. Get away. I hip-checked Timby before he could get his hand on it.
You're mean!
Out! Out! I herded them into the living room.
Mom, can we use your computer to watch walking stick videos?
I have to get going, Spencer said. One second, I shut the door. I stepped behind Joe's desk, tucked my hands behind my back in reverse prayer, and lowered my face to the eyepiece. Between the putty blur of foreground condos, a distant yacht leaped brightly into view. Black-hulled and sleek, just the prow peeked through in sharp focus. I walked to the window. There it was, at a random dock at an industrial waterfront I never thought about but did pass on my way to Costco. A ship. I stepped back, knocking over a date tree stalk that was propped up against the wall, waist high and edged with triangular spikes, sharp like shark teeth. 100 twiny fronds dangled from the top like a prehistoric pom-pom. Joe had brought it back from Turkey, where he'd gone to do contracture release surgeries. While there, he'd met a man who'd crossed the desert from Iraq with his cloudy-eyed father. They'd heard American doctors could make the blind see. As payment, they'd sawn off a branch from the family date tree, heavy with fruit. Joe explained he wasn't that kind of doctor. They insisted Joe try a date anyway. The sweetness of the fruit might change his mind. Joe lugged that stalk on 4 planes so he'd never forget those men. I want to forget them, I cried when Joe told me the wretched tale. Get that thing out of here. He brought the stock to work only to have Ruthie chase it out, too. It ended up here in the corner. I returned to the big room and sat down at Joe's place at the table. I pushed aside the dishes.
It's where they make clothes for H&M,
Timby's voice through the cracked door in his room. I can see why that would make you feel bad, Spencer's voice. Click, 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 click. Yo-Yo standing there, dim and hopeful.
Everything I say, Timby's little voice. Piper acts like she knows more. I was telling her how I hate the Disney princesses.
You love the Disney princesses, I shouted.
I never liked them, he shouted back.
Halloween, you went as Gaston, and Gaston loves Bella, so... Slam! Went Timby's door. I lowered my forehead onto the table. It was much harder and colder than you'd think. I spread my arms out and up, just as Joe had done this morning. Not comfortable. Definitely not a position you'd find yourself in naturally. But what did it say? I'm depressed. I'm alone. I'm hurting. I need help. I sat up. Yo-Yo cocked his head. His tail dared to wag. Go away.
I know, right?
Timby said from his room.
I know, right?
Spencer answered.
I know, right?
Timby jumped in.
I know, right?
Spencer sat on top of him. And on until it was staccato and rapid fire and I half expected a disco song to erupt, but instead it was giggles.
God bless the gay and the young, or the gay and the gay.
Let's do this thing, I said, looking at Yo-Yo.
Who wants a walk?
Having heard the magic word, Yo-Yo started barking.
It's all true, I said in my high-pitched Yo-Yo voice. Let's go, Charlie Trotter. Let's go, Biscuit. Let's go, Yo-Yo-san. Let's go, Yuzi Von Boozy.
His name is Yo-Yo,
said Timby coldly, now standing there with Spencer. It's my tell, I said. When I'm anxious, I make up nicknames for the dog.
What do you have to be anxious about?
Timby asked. Things, I said. Spencer held his tongue, and we headed out to face the second half of the day.
Okay, let's get this over with,
I did or didn't say out loud as we walked down the steep incline, the autumn wind whipping through the corridor of apartment buildings. The Olympic Sculpture Park, once a contaminated industrial site and now an impeccably designed waterfront public space, hummed with activity.
A busload of children played hide-and-seek in a valley of rusted Richard Serras. Lovers lolled on quilts in the shadow of an enormous calder, a pop of red amidst the cool blues and greens.
A bicycle club rested at the Claus Oldenburg typewriter eraser and squirted water into their mouths. Teens with Down syndrome gripping handles on a rope line hooted as they weaved through the Louise Bourgeois' black marble eyes. Tourists snapped gag pictures of themselves holding the space needle in their palms. Sculptures everywhere, whimsical or baffling, challenging or just plain lovely. Placed near all discreet plaques etched with names of donors well known in Seattle and beyond. Gates, Allen, Wright, Shirley, Benaroya. Taking in the joyful mix drawn together by a common enjoyment of art, I couldn't help but think, rich people, you gotta love 'em. I'll catch up with you, Spencer said, and ran in the direction of the glass pavilion marking the park's entrance. If he didn't stop until he crossed into Canada, I wouldn't have blamed him. Timby and I headed along the wide path that gently zigzagged down to the water. I was sorry to hear about Piper, I said. You need to tell me these things. Not if you don't want to, but come on. We're buds. Timby jammed his head into my side and put my arm around his shoulder.
Mom, he said, what's your favorite season?
I'll have to go with the obvious. Spring.
Mine is winter, he stated proudly.
Winter, I said.
Because of snow.
When have you ever seen snow?
Remember that time we went to the Salish Lodge, and Dad's patient who owns it got us that really big room, and then we woke up, and it was super quiet, and then you said, open the curtain, and it was snowing, and I ran outside and rolled around in my pajamas, and then I caught snowflakes on my tongue, and then Dad and I made a snowman that was full of leaves, and then I thought a bee stung me, but it was just ice inside my slipper.
Why don't we do that more often, I said.
Because you don't like being cold.
Oof. Instead of my accustomed rat-a-tat-tat, I paused to let myself feel the ache of the myriad of ways I've disappointed Timby. We walked quietly for a while.
Mama, Timby said. Piper Veal called me a bad word.
What did she call you?
Then I'm saying a bad word.
Tell me the first letter.
C.
Timby's voice cracked. C, I said. A third grader called you the C word?
Yeah. Cow.
Cow?
Why are you laughing? He said.
I'm sorry, it's not funny. It's just shocking and rude.
It means I'm fat, Timby said.
Oh, sweetie, don't say that. I wouldn't have you any other way. Besides, soon you'll shoot up like a beanstalk.
I hope it's really soon, he said.
When I was your age, my father took me shopping and I had to buy my clothes in the chunky section.
Who called it that?
I don't know, I said. Some awful store in Glenwood Springs. There was a section with the sign, chunky.
Poor Mama.
Eight was the best age.
That's the thing about hard times, I said. Generally speaking, one survives.
Yo-Yo stuck his head into a boxwood and emerged with half a burrito. If it's one thing that dog has a talent for, it's sticking his head into a bush and coming out with 7-Eleven. He gobbled the burrito, foil and all.
Mom! Timby cried.
I reached into Yo-Yo's mouth, hooked out the drooly stub, and tossed it in the trash. Yo-Yo, on the verge of panic, fixed his attention on me.
It's gone!
I presented my empty hands with a Vegas dealer clap, but it meant nothing. Let's go, you stupid dog. I yanked the leash. He yanked back. I nudged him with my foot.
Don't kick him! Timby cried.
That's not kicking. People hadn't stopped to watch, but they were certainly slowing down to judge.
We arrived at the bottom of the hill, looked both ways for cyclists, and crossed the bike path onto a lawn that rolled down to water.
A square of grass had been staked off in caution tape. Within two framed panes of glass were mounted on poles at eye level.
Is something going in those?
Timby asked. Like I had any idea. A guy in painter's pants and a T-shirt was crouched over something, his back to us. At his side was a black plastic cart piled with tools. Suddenly, a spray of water arched over our heads and squirted the glass. The worker jumped out of the way. It was Spencer behind us, pointing to a hose.
You found me,
he said. The glass on the left glistened with water pebbles, but the one on the right...
It's coated in high-tech liquid repellent, Spencer explained. Water bounces right off.
I ducked under the yellow tape and touched the glass. It was magically dry.
When the Seattle Art Museum commissioned an outdoor piece, Spencer said, I thought, yay, I get to play with rain. I remembered you'd moved here. Et voila.
Me? Spencer led me by the hand. The workman held a level between his teeth as he affixed a plaque to a concrete stump.
Careerist, artist, Spencer Martell, American, born 1977. If it was shock and delight Spencer was after, I certainly delivered. In one frame, the cedars beyond wobbled through water drops. The other, the same view, bold and crisp.
Careerist is the canvas covered with tears, I said, figuring it out. It's distorted by emotion. Artist is the identical image freed from self-pity.
Spencer's hands flew up to his face in mock horror.
Could you make me sound any more maudlin and faggy?
Timby gasped at the bad word.
This is what an artist does.
Who was I even talking to? Look around. There's everything to choose from. The vastness of the sky, the blues of the water, fairies, sailboats, mountains, and everywhere you look, people. Timby, come here. I was apparently talking to him. He instinctively took a step back. Have you ever seen such abundance? I picked up my son so he was eye level with the frames. But this is art. Daring to put a frame around something, signing your name, and letting it speak for itself.
Listen to your mother, Spencer said.
At Cooper Union, I had to take history of photography. Who's the guy who took the pictures of those sisters in the 70s, lined up like a Christmas card year after year?
Nicholas Nixon, Spencer said. The Brown sisters.
Thank you. I was having a serious problem with photography in general. When we got to Nicholas Nixon, I said to my professor,
"That's so random. I could have taken those."
And he said, "But you didn't." Nicholas Nixon did, and he put his name on it, and that's what makes it art.
And he did it over and over, Spencer said.
He persisted, I said, and it became a body of work. I turned to Timby. I don't mean to ruin the ending for you, sweet child, but life is one long headwind. To make any kind of impact requires self-will bordering on madness. The world will be hostile. It'll be suspicious of your intent. It'll misinterpret you. It will inject you with doubt. It will flatter you into self-sabotage. My God, I'm making it sound so glamorous and personal. What the world is, more than anything, it's indifferent.
Say amen to that, Spencer said.
But you have a vision. You put a frame around it. You sign your name anyway. That's the risk. That's the leap. That's the madness, thinking anyone's going to care.
Mom, you're saying the same thing over and over.
I'm embarrassing you, am I?
Stop.
To throw gas on the fire, I stuck my butt out, assumed my shake-your-booty crouch, and my eyes locked on something through the tear-stained glass, perfectly framed. The yacht! The dock was a 10-minute walk up the bike path. Spencer, I said, can you watch Timby?
Shoot, he said. I'm meeting my curator in the pavilion.
Perfect, I said. Timby knows my number.
Mom!
I handed Timby my purse. Gum, makeup, it's all yours.
Ooh!
He hooked the purse smartly around his shoulder.
Go!
The yacht, the third largest in the world, belonged to the Russian oligarch Viktor Pasternak, who'd gotten stinking rich on natural gas. Last month, he'd gone snorkeling in Hawaii, where one hooker got jealous of a different hooker and threw a black sea urchin at Victor's head. He'd covered his face in time, but the poisonous spikes got stuck in his hand. When it began to swell, he took off for Seattle because he'd heard about the guy.
A sea urchin defense wound, Joe remarked gleefully when he received the call.
Victor lived by a credo he'd dubbed the 8-minute rule. He'd calculated he was rich enough that he didn't have to do anything he didn't want for more than 8 minutes. That included being in hospitals, which he mortally feared due to an overreaction to a recent Anderson Cooper piece on antibiotic-resistant staph infections. Victor kept saying Cooper Anderson, but Joe didn't correct him. So Victor converted the disco on his yacht into an operating room. He'd invited Joe to the yacht, presented him with the state-of-the-art setup, and announced it was where Joe would be removing the hooker-delivered sea urchin spikes. Joe, not being insane, balked. Victor persisted. His equipment had been installed under the supervision of Spain's Dr. Luis Rogoway, famous for operating on the knees of European soccer stars. Rogoway, a great friend, would fly in his nursing staff, gorgeous Spanish women, none shorter than 6 feet, to assist Joe. Joe thought about it. Audacious, yes, but unethical? No law said you had to operate in a hospital. Joe had done 100 procedures on dirt floor dwellings in Haiti, India, Ethiopia. Insurance companies wanted you to do everything in the hospital. This guy was obscenely overpaying in cash. It was an out-of-body moment, one Joe still didn't quite understand when he heard himself saying yes. Victor had another stipulation. Joe had to clear his schedule for the week-long recovery. That's why Joe had told his staff he was out of town. As for why Joe didn't tell me, he knew I'd be a gusher of opinions, all negative, and who needs that the night before you're performing surgery in an unfamiliar disco? Joe made the decision to operate, donate the money to charity, and laugh with me later. On the appointed day, Joe opened Victor's hand, removed the sea urchin spikes, and repaired the tendon damage without incident. before closing the hand, Joe wanted to zap any lingering bacteria. He instructed the Spanish nurse to turn on the UV light. Her English being less than bueno, she hit the wrong switch. A pound of glitter dumped onto the operating table and into Victor's open hand. After 15 minutes of recriminations, panicked discussion about the relative filth factor of Chinese glitter, and a torrent of cursing straight from the Tower of Babel, much of it from the patient himself, Joe was frog-marched off the yacht by Uzi-packing security. For days he'd been trying to get in touch with Victor, but he'd been cut dead. Joe whiled away the week at Mariners games. Was heading into October, so they were in the playoffs. He'd bought a high-powered telescope to monitor the comings and goings around the yacht, still ominously in port. A black sedan from the state's medical board had arrived at the pier this morning. The thought of it was so revolting it had rendered Joe face down at the breakfast table. Was I insane? Joe hadn't operated on a Russian oligarch in the disco of his yacht. He wasn't assisted by a staff of perfect 10 Spanish nurses. Where did I come up with that? A Robert Palmer video? One of whom had accidentally glitter-bombed the surgery? The medical board doesn't have a black sedan. The Mariners have no chance of making the playoffs. This witch was on tilt. The yacht, I realized when I arrived at the dock, was no yacht at all, but a banged-up squid boat. How did I know? A van from Rene Erickson's restaurant empire was parked at the pier. A tattooed chef, is there any other kind, haggled with a fisherman over a sea creature the size of a toilet. A fluorescent cloud of cyclists whizzed past and practically knocked me off my feet. I was standing in the middle of the bike path, clueless and let down, unmoored from space and time. Yo-Yo sighed. "You and me both," I said to him. Could Joe have been looking at something behind the boat? No. Across a small channel, there was only a row of corrugated metal buildings, a nautical supply house, a marine fuel station, and beyond them, a Costco. I sat on a guardrail. Yo-Yo placed his front legs on my lap and waited for a head scratch. What I knew... Joe had told the girls in the office he was out of town for a week. Spencer's call today had placed Joe at the end of that stretch. But as of this morning, he was face down on the breakfast table. He must be going somewhere each day without telling anyone. And at some point, he'd aimed a telescope at this exact spot. Oh, this was ridiculous. I called Joe's cell. He picked up after one ring. Hey, babe. Joe. My calm voice belied my heart, which had broken loose in my chest. Where are you?
At the office. Why?
Yow. I realized I wasn't dreading a scene. I was itching for one. I was ready to jack this party up to 11 and start breaking some plates. The last thing I could have fathomed was that I'd be lied to with such calm clarity and conviction. See words? They're everywhere today. I'd like to say such a thing had never happened to me before, but I knew sickeningly well it had, 8 years before, at the hands of my sister Ivy. It's the last impression I have of her, the cool betrayal. But now Joe? If there's one thing in this world I thought I could count on, it was that Joe was no liar. But here he was, lying. Yo-Yo pawed at my lap. I stopped scratching his head. Just thought I'd check in. I matched Joe's nonchalance and raised him a bored sigh. All's well? He asked. You know how it is. I myself am hell. Nobody's here, only skunks, I said.
Do I ever, he said.
I had to pick up Timby at school. It's a long story involving cheaply made clothing, Bangladeshi slaves, and an antagonist with the last name Veal. This was better than a scene. It was so exotic, so uncharted. It was forging a new pathway. The two of us, liars. I actually felt closer to Joe in a kinky, thrilling way. Lying! The middle-aged sex? I'll fill you in tonight, I said. I'm stuck at a thing, he said. I might be late.
For years I'd been cataloging traits of Joe's that annoyed me, things I'd be relieved to have out of my life should he ever decide to leave me. The gratitude list, I called it. 1. When I get out of the shower and ask Joe to hand me a towel, he invariably hands me a damp one. 2. He has never once offered to walk Yo-Yo. He'll walk Yo-Yo, but only after making me play the Harridan. 3. When we go out to restaurants, he puts leftover dinner rolls in his socks and brings them home so they won't go to waste. 4. Said dinner rolls get placed on his bedside table until he notices them a week later, at which point he hands me the Wheatstones and asks me to use them in something, thus the frequency of bread pudding. No wonder poor Timby is a chunkster. 5. Every time we go to a movie and it starts 20 minutes late because of the previews, Joe goes nuts, showing me his watch and informing me and everyone else in the theater what time the movie was scheduled to be in. 6. When we run a fan to cool down a room, he insists it point into the room, not out, which just seems wrong. 7. He puts sriracha on everything I make, even waffles. My gratitude list was self-protection. I started composing it the morning after Joe and I first said, I love you, at Dojo on St. Mark's Place. Bob Marley's Legend was playing in the background. This was New York in the 90s. When wasn't Legend playing in the background? Joe was due at the hospital at 5:30 a.m. He'd showered and dressed quietly enough, but then he sat at the end of my bed on my feet and put on his shoes. Just so you don't take me for a complete scorekeeping bitch, which I am, but there's better evidence. Joe freely admits he's essentially selfish. It's the single piece of insight he received the one time he went to a shrink. Me, on the other hand, I've been to 9 shrinks in 20 years, and I'm still like, wait, what? This selfishness, according to Joe's miracle shrink, was a response to being one of 7 children. Every time a box of Quisp or Quake was unpacked from the grocery bag, kids descended on it in a feeding frenzy. Joe shared a room with 3 brothers. Control of the remote, a private place to read Playboy, everything a cage match to the death. The fault, of course, lay with the Catholic Church, which encourages lower-class families to reproduce like rodents and build up the church's ranks, blah, blah. Another item for the gratitude list. No more Joe railing against religion. In fact, that dinner at Dojo, it wasn't Rasta Bob singing, I want to love you every day and every night, that inspired Joe to declare the 3 words that sealed our fate. It was the following discussion of the New Testament. Joe, it's doggerel, aggrandizing, a moody egomaniac written by men who believed heaven was 100 feet above their heads. Literally. So when Christ ascended, he didn't go higher than a 7-story building. Me. Who cares? Joe. The hours I wasted listening to that contradictory claptrap. The things I could have done with that time. I could have learned another language or leathercraft. Me. I was brought up Catholic, too, you know. When I was 7, they were teaching us about the loaves and the fishes. I raised my hand and said, that couldn't really happen. Sister Bridget, not happy, responded with, faith requires the mind of a child. I said, but I am a child, she replied, a younger child. I thought, what a load of malarkey, and never looked back. Joe. So you just turned atheist? Wasn't it a struggle? Me. Let's not and say we did, is my attitude. Joe. I love you. Me. I knew it was a blurt that didn't count, but still, you gotta jump on these things. I love you too, Joe. I'd officially fallen in love the week before in the Adirondacks and was just waiting for him to say it first. Violet Perry, the creator of Looper Wash, had rented a lake house and invited the animators and their significant others for a bonding weekend. I'd only just met Joe, so
New work friends plus new guy equals doubly scary.
It was July 4th.
Rumor had it if we hiked to the ridge, we could watch the fireworks from the town on the other side. Only after the evening fell and we were getting ready to go did we discover that none of the cabin's dozen flashlights worked. We groused and resigned ourselves to a boozy night on the porch. Joe didn't come outside. I found him alone in the kitchen counter. He disassembled the flashlights and laid them out like surgical instruments. He'd swapped bulbs, scrubbed off crusted batteries, and was folding tinfoil into small squares. So peacefully absorbed, so competent, so dear. That was the moment. I'm not kidding. Within 30 minutes, Joe had 10 of those flashlights working. As we headed up the forest path, Violet pointed to Joe and mouthed, "Keep him." Had I lost him? Might there be someone else? Yo-Yo's eyes were closed. His face was raised to the sun. Come to think of it, he was pretty useless. Thanks a lot, Joe. You left me for another woman and turned me against my dog. If Jerry Garcia were alive, he could sing a song about it. The fishermen helped the tattooed chef load the squid into an ice chest. I caught them looking at me. Had they been talking about me? I gave them a nod. They carried on with their business. I revisited my gratitude list. Oh, another one. Joe reads in bed long after I go to sleep. No amount of passive-aggressive tossing and turning on my part, nor looking at the clock, nor dramatically putting a pillow over my head will make him turn off the light. When he finally does, he'll sometimes rest his book on me. And these aren't slim volumes of poetry. They're Winston Churchill biographies, and Winston Churchill lived a very full life. The van door slammed shut. The fisherman was gone. The chef came around the side. Our eyes caught. I held his gaze. He held mine. It's not that I wanted to get anything going with this guy, but it was too weird. And then he was walking toward me with an intrigued half-smile. I don't put my hair in a clip for one day, and this happens. A hot chef, knowing he's got squid in the back of his van, boldly crosses a parking lot to start up a conversation with a middle-aged woman? This brave new world could not have come at a better time.
I have to ask, he said.
I have to answer.
What kind of dog is this?
I was as desirable as a hedge. That's what happens when you lose your sex drive. I can put on Belgian dresses, wear my hair down, and flirt garishly, but when it comes to real currency, sexual currency, I had none. This morning, when Joe said of Yo-Yo, I know what he's getting out of us, I just don't know what we're getting out of him, he wasn't only talking about the dog. I offered the chef the leash. He's a mutt, I said. Want him?
Wow, he said. No, but thanks, he sure is cute.
With that, my gentleman caller disappeared into the ether. It's not like I don't come with my own grab bag of flaws. Although Joe is far too superior to catalog his grievances toward me, they might include, 1, once I ate a bagel on the toilet, 2, I use too much floss, 3, I floss in bed, 4, I take the dog into the shower with me to wash him, 5, I take my first bite of popcorn at the movies by touching my tongue to the top of the popcorn and eating what sticks. But Joe always says he doesn't want popcorn because it's too salty, so it's mine, and can't I eat it the way I want? 6, I toss milk duds into the popcorn. 7, actually, I bite the milk duds into 4 pieces and spit them back into the popcorn so they're smaller, giving me a better popcorn-to-milk-dud ratio. Yes, they're covered in saliva, but it's my saliva, though I can see how, to someone reaching into the popcorn he said he wasn't going to eat, it could be an issue. Joe wouldn't say this because he's a gentleman, but I will. I'm looking worse by the day. I'm all jowly, my back is dry, I have a bush the size of a dinner plate. My core strength is non-existent. Menopause means your metabolism skids to a stop and you lose 30% of your muscle mass. In other words, the self-discipline to watch my weight, which I never had to begin with. I now need more of,
Really, I'm hanging by a thread here.
Sure, Joe had spent breakfast with his face down on the table, but at least he was still in the same room with me.
Yo-Yo, bored with the hot sun, let out a snorty yawn. Come on, gratitude list, work your magic. I haven't nursed you all these years for nothing.
The whole idea was when Joe finally hit the eject button, I'd feel free too. Kind of like that first shower after getting my hair chopped off, or those first steps in a new pair of cushiony running shoes, or seeing the world through new, stronger prescription lenses.
Could this be happening? Could the elixir I'd been squirreling away for decades have lost its fizz? Was it me? Was it Joe? Was it the passage of time? Was I too tired to care?
Earlier this year, I told a mother at school I'd been married 15 years. She asked, "What's the secret to a long marriage?" I thought for a second, then answered, "Staying married." Was it happiness I'd found in my long marriage, or capitulation? Or is that all happiness is? Capitulation. The story of our marriage was in frames all over our apartment. Joe and I riding to the Emmys in the back of a limo. Me surprising Joe during a medical conference in Chicago and having someone take our picture in front of Cy Twombly's peonies. Moments later, Joe asked me to marry him in front of the bean with a ring he'd grabbed at the museum gift shop. Our wedding in Violet Perry's backyard and Martha's Vineyard. Giving birth to Timby at home on Thanksgiving Day, the TV on in the background, the cast of Sunday in the Park with George performing during the Macy's parade, Sunday by the blue, purple, yellow, red water, Joe opening the Wallace Surgery Center, Timby's first day of kindergarten. But standing there in the weak October sun, a different story of our marriage presented itself. It was as if all those years Joe and I had been followed by a photographer snapping pictures of us unawares, Joe and me reading quietly in bed, Timby playing Legos at our feet, me looking out the window seeing Joe and Timby below walking home from the science center, me standing on the Gaylor Street lawn in the drizzle early for pickup, Yo-Yo snoring in the living room so loud none of us could sleep. The three of us sitting on the curb outside Portage Bay, waiting for them to call our name for brunch. That was happiness, not the framed greatest hits, but the moments between. At the time, I hadn't pegged them as being particularly happy, but now, looking back at those phantom snapshots, I'm struck by my calm, my ease, the evident comfort with my life. I'm happy in retrospect.
Oh, Joe, take me back, and I promise I'll make love to you twice a week and never eat a bagel on the toilet again. I appreciate the quiet moments. And hey, could it be Alonzo walking on a pedestrian overpass spanning Elliott Avenue? I watched him go down the stairs and head into the Costco parking lot. This was perfect. I needed to apologize for calling him my poet. Alonzo had changed into jeans and a red polo shirt, but he was unmistakable from afar with his sturdy frame and regal carriage. "Let's go," I said to Yo-Yo, who jumped so vigorously out of his sleep I feared we both might tear muscles. Cars were few on the edge of the Costco parking lot. Yo-Yo's friskiness toggled to despair as I tied him to an empty shopping cart rack and sliced the air with my index finger. "You stay." Alonzo's mop top bobbed over the parked cars in the distance and stopped at a rack filled with pony packs of marigolds. Alonzo took in the unremarkable sight and threw his head back with a jolly laugh. Poets. I needed to be more like them. Alonzo spotted something on the ground, I couldn't see what, and leaned over to pick it up. He then disappeared into the shadowy maw of Costco. This was my Costco, and it wasn't like I hadn't lost Timby in here more than once, so I'd perfected the art of finding moving targets. My secret? To canvas the place like I was drawing that house with the X through it without lifting my pencil. I entered and jogged along the left wall, checking the aisles to my right. When I reached the top left corner, I crossed through the wine and hung a left, which landed me in toilet paper. Still, no Alonzo. Last time I was here was a year ago, after an hour spent filling my cart so high it handled like a bumper car and required an arm across the top so everything wouldn't slide off, I made my way to the checkout line. A wave of misanthropy swept over me. Why did that lady need a whole drum of red vines? What would someone even do with 100 combs? Did that fatso really need a laminator all to herself? Couldn't she just go to Kinko's? Or that guy, what was he doing with 6-gallon jugs of generic scotch? And why must they all wear shorts? Thank God I wasn't one of them. Me with my case of highly rated New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, my pound of fresh pineapple spears, my salt and pepper pistachios, my 12-pack of dental floss. My items painted a clear picture of my sophistication, my superior taste, my sparkling intelligence. I abandoned my cart in the checkout line and walked out empty-handed. I felt bad for the person who had to return my stuff to the proper shelves. I felt worse when I realized it was probably cheaper for Costco to just throw it all away. I crossed through the produce. Impossibly cheap, good color, firm to the touch. What's the catch? Too many seeds. As good as it all looks on the outside, take it home and it's filled with a freakish number of seeds. English cucumbers, dense with flat, leathery seeds. Lemons, you dull your knife on all the seeds. Cherry tomatoes, jammed with tiny, slimy seeds. Not that I'd ever buy chicken at Costco, but if I did, I could imagine slicing it open and seeds pouring out. A mob of Seahawks fans blocked the way to the bakery. Racks of cupcakes were being rolled out, a dozen to a shrink-wrapped sheet, each frosted blue with a green 12. Across the aisle, a bigger mob swarming cupcakes decorated with Pope hats, also with the number 12. The only thing you need to know about Seattle, nobody was offended. I arrived at the gauntlet of food sample people. They stuck to their script without deviation and avoided eye contact. America's version of the Buckingham Palace Guards, if the Buckingham Palace Guards had terrible posture and filled you with existential dread. "Jack Cheese," said a woman, "in 4 zesty flavors. Stock up for the holidays." "Breaded steak fish," a voice droned. "Fresh from Alaska and a perfect option for a healthy, nutritious dinner. Try it tonight. Breaded steak fish." My attention snagged on the slight southern accent. My head jerked back. My body turned. There he was, in a blue apron and shower cap, manning a little counter. My poet, with a marigold in the buttonhole of his polo shirt. "Fresh from Alaska and a perfect option for a healthy, nutritious dinner. Try it tonight." I was jolted back by the mashup of high and low. The red plastic tray, damp and smelling of industrial dishwater, his encyclopedic knowledge of the lives of the poets, the toaster oven door stained brown with grease, Eleanor. "Alonzo!" I opened my arms for a hug. He looked down. He couldn't step off his mat. "What's this?" I said, picking up a little sample cup. "Breaded steak fish." "I've heard it's fresh from Alaska and perfect for a nutritious dinner." "A perfect option for a healthy, nutritious dinner," Alonzo corrected. The whole exchange had an easy grace. "Don't mind if I do." I dropped the morsel of fish on my tongue. Not my favorite. Alonzo handed me a napkin and pointed to a trash can across the aisle. When I turned back, a man was standing at Alonzo's station, kicking the tires, so to speak, of free food.
"What's steak fish?" he asked.
"Tilapia," Alonzo answered.
"Tilapia?" the man said with suspicion.
"It's a sustainable farm-grown replacement for pollock."
"Never heard of that either."
"It has the texture of steak," Alonzo offered. The man took a bite.
"This?"
"I think it tastes fabulous," I said. "I'll take 5 cartons. The weary customer shook his head as I grabbed my stack. "See you next week," I said to Alonzo. "Same bat time." "Oh," I said, "what's our next poem?" "At the Fish Houses by Elizabeth Bishop." "But of course," I said. Sometimes victory knocks on your window even though you never sent out an invitation. This is what today was supposed to be about. I had been present. I had been kind. I had radiated happiness. True, I'd completely forgotten to apologize to Alonzo, but I did turn what might have been an awkward situation into a respect-filled exchange, bobbing with wit and sophistication. Chalk one up for me, leaving the world a better place than I'd found it. But first, what to do with this goddamn steak fish? I made sure nobody was looking, nestled all 5 boxes in a bin of loose T-shirts, and got the hell out. I stepped outside and got smacked by the sun. Yikes! I'd been gone 45 minutes. Spencer hadn't called, which I considered a minor miracle. This middle-aged body would have to do the last thing anyone wanted to see, run back to the sculpture park. Wait! It was Alonzo charging out, tugging at his blue apron as if being attacked by bees. Alonzo? He finally freed himself from the apron and whipped it to the ground. He crouched for a moment, hands on quads. This was no athlete either. I can't do it. The degradation, the dehumanization, the perversion of the English language. He pulled out a pack of American Spirits, tapped out a cigarette, and lit it with a mini Bic. To my enormous credit, I didn't spend the next 5 minutes haranguing him for being a filthy, self-destructive smoker. It was that look on your face, he said after the first drag. My face was beatific and serene, wasn't it? That made it worse, seeing how hard you were working just to look me in the eye. I swear, I said, I can't win for losing. I'm not sure that's what that means, cigarette in mouth. Alonzo picked up his apron, balled it up, and drop-kicked it into a nearby dumpster. Oh, Alonzo, I said. A motorized zzzt approached, followed by a slurring, high-pitched voice.
You don't want to do that!
It was a guy in a wheelchair with a tall safety flag. He wore a Costco name tag, Jimmy. His ear was frozen to his shoulder, and his good arm worked a joystick.
That's a $25 deposit on that apron, Jimmy said,
scooting into Alonzo's personal space. Alonzo kept smoking and listened with an air of amused detachment.
I've seen a lot of people flip out and quit, Jimmy continued. Usually they throw their apron in the bin over there. Don't return it and they deduct it from your last paycheck.
Thank you, Alonzo said. But I honestly don't give a rat's ass. Hey, I said, you're a poet. Talk like one.
They empty that trash at 12, 3, and 6, Jimmy said. I've seen a lot of folks have second thoughts. Come back, but it's gone.
I stand on my little mat flogging my fish story, fresh from Alaska. On the box, there's an icy, roaring stream jumping with sassy fish. Really, it's antibiotic pumped tilapia farmed in Vietnam that maybe makes a stopover in Alaska. But hey, the price is right. Americans, you can see it in their walk. If they find something cheap, it puts a disgusting little bounce in their step. Okay, I said. And yet it genuinely pains me when people like you spit out my samples. I didn't spit it out. I saw you, he said. Yesterday was worse. Yesterday they gave me ostrich jerky.
That was you?
Jimmy said, his chair leaping back with a zzz. I didn't kill the ostriches. I didn't hang them up to dry and hack them into strips. I just handed it out. I'm a poet.
Do you mind if we do this in the shade?
Asked Jimmy. He put his chair in reverse and zzzed it backward. Do what in the shade? I watched him recede farther away from where I needed to be, and yesterday, the sculpture park.
Our talk,
Jimmy shouted from under the eave of Costco. We're not having a talk, I said. Alonzo lowered himself onto the curb, a 3-step process accompanied by a fair amount of grunting. No, don't sit down, I said. Ugh, I'm telling you, I don't know whether to shit or go blind. Shit, Alonzo said. It's hardly Sophie's choice. He was now cradling his head in his hands. Costco's the only insurance that pays for in vitro. My wife's gonna kill me. But nothing is worth another hour of that place. Come on, Alonzo, I patted his back.
All work has dignity.
She's right,
called Jimmy from the shade.
Not that work,
Alonzo shouted back. He turned to me.
A puzzled look befell his face. Wait, what happened to your steak fish?
Right, it was delicious, but my son is with a stranger who expected me back an hour ago, and the line was really long, and... Jimmy motored over.
Where did you leave him? I'm not going to turn you in. It's just they could thaw.
In a basket of T-shirts.
Ooh, Jimmy said. You better show me.
Yeah, Alonzo said, show him. No. I reached through my legs, pulled up the back hem of my dress, and tied it in a three-way knot. Looking like Gandhi from the waist down, I climbed the rungs of the dumpster.
My life, I said, is with my son, who I need to get back to before someone calls child services.
I snatched the apron and tossed it at Alonzo's chest. He let it bounce off.
Your life, I said to Alonzo, hopping down, is in that Costco.
I tied the apron around his neck.
Jimmy, I said.
Yes, ma'am.
Your life is escorting Alonzo back to his steakfish station.
Can do.
I'm a poet, Alonzo said. I'm writing a novel. It's called Marigold, My Marigold. When I came to work, I passed a rack of marigolds. As I did, one broke off. This one, it was a sign. Today is the day my novel comes first.
Alonzo, I said, quit tomorrow. I don't care. Just talk it over with your wife. I aimed him back in the direction of Costco.
Go back to your darkling plane, I said, giving him a helpful shove. Everything will be fine.
My what? Alonzo asked, turning back.
Your little standing mat, your darkling plane.
Ah, pretend I never said it.
I'd love to tell you I jogged a half mile back to the museum at a measured and steady pace.
Really?
I sprinted with boobs flapping, arkrum calves wobbling, throat burning, blister on the inside of my right heel forming, and stopped after 100 feet. My phone vibrated in my pocket. Spencer must have waterboarded my number out of the recesses of Timby's mind.
Yes, hello?
Am I speaking with Eleanor Flood?
I took my phone away from my ear. Joyce Prim.
Joyce, hi, I've been meaning to call.
This is Cameron Karras Sconyers, the voice said. I'm an editor at Burton Hill.
Whatever was about to happen, I had the strongest premonition I shouldn't hear it standing up. I'd arrived at a small fishing pier. A Native American in a jean jacket sat on a bench with a portable radio. At his feet was a bucket filled with bloody gunk, bait for sale. He nodded at the empty spot beside him. I sat down.
Nice to meet you,
I said to Ms. Karras Sconyers.
I'm calling because we're moving our offices downtown, and I've been going through our files and found one for the Flood Girls. I'm wondering what you'd like us to do with it.
Oh, Joyce will know.
Joyce?
Joyce Prim, I said. My editor. Let me speak with her.
Joyce Prim isn't with Burton Hill anymore.
So that's why Joyce had been calling, to tell me she was going to another publisher.
Where did she land? I asked.
At a cheese shop in Nyack.
Oh.
I heard it's a really good cheese shop, Cameron offered.
So it hadn't been Joyce Prim calling. My phone just thought so because I'd entered Burton Hill's main number in my address book.
What a singular sensation to have the facts of my career unraveling and raveling back up all at the same time.
And so my book, I asked.
The Flood Girls, she said. It was kind of due 8 years ago.
Did I say I was a little late? I guess it's 8 years late.
But I did say I was bad with dates and numbers and names, although Cameron Karras Sconyers is one I won't soon forget.
Are you my new editor?
I edit YA.
YA graphic novels? I'm sorry, I'm confused.
We're not doing a lot of graphic novels anymore, Cameron said. They were big 10 years ago, but we got burned by a few. You know, Joyce and her cheese shop.
So you're saying my book is canceled? I said.
You're just going to eat my advance?
I suppose we could sue you, she said helpfully.
That's okay.
I feel bad, Cameron said. Maybe this is a conversation you should be having with your agent. Who's your agent?
Sheridan Smith, I said.
Right.
What?
Someone said she's a homeopath in Colorado.
She is?
Publishing, Cameron said. You might have heard, we've been going through a rough patch.
She.
You can still write your book, she said sweetly. It probably just won't be for us.
Oh,
she'd almost forgotten. This file, I'm not sure if you want us to send it to you. Looks like contracts or correspondence. A Christmas card you drew for Joyce where instead of a reindeer, it's the looper wash ponies. And instead of Santa, it's that guy with the thing whose name I can't remember. I hung up and dropped my phone into the bait bucket. I sensed a strong gaze. The Native American.
Bad call, he said.
Bad call, I said, and walked away.
My Oxfords crunched up the sculpture garden path toward the glass pavilion. My body was numb and made of feathers. People and sculptures grew denser until I was in thick with picnickers packing up, mothers chasing toddlers, tourists posing, the spindly legs of the red Calder spaceship teetering. Oof! I was on the grass. I'd tripped on an outdoor light.
I need help.
It was a story Joe once told. He was in Indianapolis for the NFL Combine, and he'd gotten food poisoning. He'd spent all night on the tile floor of his hotel bathroom burning with fever. Vomit, sweat, diarrhea, name an orifice, there was something coming out of it. He found himself moaning, I need help. Someone help me. As a doctor, Joe knew he didn't need help. His body simply had a bug, and the quicker he expelled it, the better. But he found himself made better in another way by the act of repeating those words. I need help. Somebody help me. He said them over and over until he started laughing. The next morning at breakfast, he overheard people at the buffet. Did you hear that poor fucker last night? I hope somebody helped him. I hated that story. Joe was my competent traveler. He wasn't the one who laughed naked on the shower floor of a Holiday Inn Express. He didn't cry out helplessly to no one. I'd forced myself to forget the whole episode until now. I picked myself up off the grass. I sprinted the rest of the way, a bead of red running down my shin. The glass of the pavilion was pure reflection, orange, the color of birch leaves, flat-bottom clouds skipped across the sky. In a patch of inky ocean, I could make out Spencer standing with his back to me. A sign, closed for installation. The door was propped open. Spencer conferred with a gaggle of art types, at their feet a patchwork of furniture pads. Men in blue rubber gloves. The guy from before, still with the level in his teeth. An older woman with wild gray hair and harlequin-patterned tights spoke with her hands. Spencer noticed me over his shoulder. He shot me a very annoyed look. Annoyance. How quaint. I spotted Timby in the corner, legs folded impossibly underneath him, examining with quiet concentration the contents of my purse. Timby, with his pinch pots and darling belly and paper airplanes and backward Ys and his love of winter and carbs and walking sticks and his scavenging for clues to help him better understand the screwy adult world. Timby, it's not your fault my mother died when I was your age. You don't know that all the time you have with me from now on is a gift. It's not your fault I can't absorb that lesson myself, that I'm cobbled together from broken promises of jigsaw puzzles never started and potholder kits unopened. That's why Timby reads Archie. It's a steady group of characters behaving predictably. It's a world with the guarantee of small-scale problems. How do I break it to you that people aren't predictable? that life is confounding and sadistic in its cruelty? That when things go your way, it never makes you as happy as you'd expected, but when things go against you, it's a cold water jolt, an unshakable outrage that dogs you forever. But I can be steady. I will show you kindness and bring you snow.
Mom?
In Timby's hand.